Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section. This is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I'm happy to bring you Chapter 32 of Sefer Yeshayahu. Chapter 31 ends off with the destruction of Ashur and the salvation of Yerushalayim and its inhabitants. So in Chapter 32, we really continue and focus on the righteousness of the king and his establishment of a just social order. That is, the step beyond the destruction of Ashur is the establishment of a true kingdom in Judah and all of Israel to a certain degree. And to this question, if you ask a question, is Yeshayahu talking specifically about Chizkiyahu, or is he talking about the future Mashiach, the future king of Israel? Well, I would answer yes. That is, the answer is both. Chizkiyahu, if he would have been worthy, and unfortunately he wasn't, and some future king when he is worthy. Hein letzedek yimloch melech ulisarim lemishpat yasoru. Behold, the king will reign to do what is righteous, and ministers will be appointed to govern justly. Note that I'm translating this not so much as a prophecy, as a guarantee, but as an instruction to the king and his officers. Now, I think Yeshayahu thinks justifiably that he has a super righteous guy in Chizkiyahu that will make this prediction come true. But there is a musar, there is an instruction in the sense that not only is this the way it will be, this is the way that they have to act. V'haya ish kemachavei ruach v'seter zarem kefalgei mayim bitzayon kitzel sela kaved be'eretz ayefa. And this man will be a hiding place from storms, a shelter from downpours. He'll be like brooks of waters in dry places, like the shadow of a massive rock in a tired land. Lo tishena enei ro'im va'oznei shom'im tikshavna. And the eyes of those who look will no longer be blinded, and the eyes of those who listen will take heed. Both of these are a remedy for God's prediction or command to Yeshayahu in chapter 6, the very first prophecy, really, that Yeshayahu ever received as a prophet, where it says there, God tells Yeshayahu, Hashmein lev ha'am azev va'oznav ha'chved ve'inav hasha pen yirev ve'inav va'oznav yishma ulevavo yavin vashav v'rafalo. Lest they see with their eyes, lest they hear with their ears and come to understand and repent and be healed. But why would God want to prevent them from understanding the truth and therefore doing repentance and therefore being healed? Well, that's a completely different shir on Perek Vav, so I'll leave it alone for now. There are two ways, by the way, to understand this pasuk. It was that everyone will see and everyone will hear, or the way I translate it will be, there will still be people who don't want to hear and don't want to see, but at least the people who do want to see, enei ro'im, those who go about and come about and look, and oznei shomim, the ears, not everybody's ears, but the ears of those who want to listen, they will in fact be able to hear the truth. Uluvav nim harim yavin ladat, ulshon ilgim timaher ledaber tzachot. And the minds of the imprudent, or the impulsive, from the word maher, nimharim, will achieve knowledge, and mocking or stumbling, from the word ilg or laag, those tongues will begin to speak tzachot, clearly or eloquently. Lo yikare od linaval nadiv ulchilai lo ye amer shoah. The villain will no longer be called noble, and the deceitful will no longer be called leader. This is very much like Yeshayahu's older prophecies. Woe to they who call darkness light and light darkness, to those who call bitter sweet and sweet bitter. The idea is that these fancy players know how to take the truth and twist it and spin it to their own desires. That's the word ileg or laag, and they will start to speak truthfully, eloquently, and correctly, and that's tzachot. Ki naval navala yidaber. And now analyzing these two villains, the naval and the kilai, the villain and the deceitful one, the Navi explains what's wrong with both of them. Ki naval nivala yidaber, v'libo yase aven, la'asot chonef udaber el adunai to'a. El here doesn't really mean to speak to God mistakenly, but to speak about God mistakenly. Laharik nefesh ra'ev, umashkei tzamei yachzir. For the villains will speak villainously, his heart, or really the mind of this villain, plots evil, to do what is irreligious, to speak falsely about God, to empty hungry souls and to prevent the thirsty from drinking. That is, he finds people who are searching for God, for the truth, and he actually counsels them, using his fancy tongue, he counsels them away from truth and moves them away from God. Just kind of as an aside that I don't usually put into these shirim, but I don't know, maybe the time has come, at least for a short aside. I was once on a plane from New York to California on a business trip, and I was sitting next to a guy who seemed Jewish, and he was telling me about this camp that he set up, I don't know, Neve Shalom or something like that. I actually used Neve Shalom because it shows up later in this perek, but I don't really know if that's what it was. And it was this camp that he set up in the Catskills, and I was very impressed. He's taking Jews, and he's got a rabbi, and they're helping Jews understand their Judaism. And then the more he's talking, the more I realize that he's not Jewish. He's a Jews for Jesus guy. And what they're doing is they're finding Russian immigrants that are coming into Coney Island in that area in Brooklyn, and who know very little about their Judaism, who had just escaped from the oppression of Soviet Russia. This, of course, goes back, I have to admit, 10 years. And convince the parents or convince the kids, set up this camp, which the kids, no doubt, in their ignorance of Judaism, assume was a Jewish camp. But it turns out that it was a Jews for Jesus camp, and they were actually steering away people from Judaism into a completely different religion, but in trickery and preying upon people's weakness. So here, I don't know that the irreligion is that they're making them, turning them away from Judaism. There really wasn't such a thing. But they're turning them away from the right way of God, and perhaps away from God himself. Anyway, continuing on. I hope you'll forgive my little story. Let's continue on. The Kelai, Kelav Ra'im. The Kelai is like the Kelai, the trickster. The nave of the previous pasuk. The reason why Kelai is changed to Kelai here is because the word Kelim, it rhymes with the word Kelim, which is utensils. And the tools of the deceitful are evil. Huzimot ya'atz, l'chabel ani'im b'imre sheker, uvdaber evyon mishpat. He plans or advises evil plans to destroy or damage the poor with lies, and to damage the downtrodden when they come to speak their cases. The Nadiv, I think, of the previous pasuk is more of a politician, a social leader, leading people astray and away from the way of God so that they'll follow the leader. Here in the Kelai, it seems to be more of a justice who poor and downtrodden come to him, and he just rules in whatever way will be most satisfactory to himself rather than to the poor and to the downtrodden. Although, as I've said before, there's really not much separation between the legislative and the judicial in ancient Israel, and no doubt a Nadiv was also a Kelai, and a Kelai was also a Nadiv, but they're two different aspects of turning people away from God, one on a spiritual level and one on a social justice level. In contrast to this, v'nadiv nadivot ya'at v'hu al nadivot yakum. In contrast, the true noble plans or advises nobly, and on his nobility he will remain in his position. And nadivot also, I think, harkens back to the Mishkan with the word nadiv lev, someone who is inspired to contribute, not for the sake of money or for the sake of power, but somebody who contributes freely, somebody who really feels that you do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And that is truly noble, and a noble with a capital N needs to behave nobly. Now, it would be really nice if the chapter ended this way. And in truth, the next section could probably have been its own chapter, and this chapter, this section that we read up to this pasuk, could easily have been part of the previous chapter as a continuation of the salvation. However, from this great height of restored monarchy and righteousness and social order, we come back plummeting to earth, to the coming of the Assyrian forces. And it's some comfort, even though it's only a small comfort, to those who live in the times of terror, that they will be saved in the future, everything will be okay. But as I said, it's only a small comfort, and the Jewish people would have to be readied and prepared to deal with the terror that would come before the future salvation. And honestly, the salvation of only one city, meaning all the other cities were destroyed and the people in it destroyed or enslaved. Nashim sha'ananot, komna shema'ana koli, benot botechot Zeina Imrati. Now, as with all such prophecies, the question is, are we to understand the words literally or to look for the meaning behind the metaphor? So Rashi says these nashim, these women, and these benot, these girls, these daughters, these are not real women, that these are cities of Israel. It's similar in Shir HaShirim, where you have benot Yerushalayim, and Rashi points out the word benot can be from the word binyan, or buildings, or constructions. So Rashi says these are not real women that the Perek is talking about, that our chapter is talking about, but they're metaphoric representations of beautiful cities that will be coming down. Ibn Ezra actually says that they're real women. I tend to say, have your cake and eat it too. That is, why not both? Maybe the Nabi is asking us to read it in two levels. One on the personal level with real women in pain and crying and suffering, and women representing cities who are also being destroyed and ready for the disaster to come. Perhaps it is more meaningful and affecting if you read both the metaphor and the meaning behind the metaphor, although I think we'll see that it is quite a bit of metaphor going on in the coming psukim. So back to the pasuk, Nashima Sha'ananot Komna Shemana Koli Banot Botchot Azena Imrati. Up, up, you women who are at ease. Listen to my voice. Hear my words, you confident daughters. Yamim al Shana Tirgazna Botchot Ki Kalavatsir Osef Beliavo. In 1 year, your confidence will be shaken, for your vintage is coming to an end. Your harvest will not come in. Remember, by the way, in chapter 29, they had 2 years, Shana al Shana, and the Chagim Yikofu, the holidays were cycling around. But now the countdown is down to 1 year. And I mentioned that last chapter. This chapter 31 and 32, which seem to be recapping stuff, could probably best be understood as the day of doom is getting closer. So Yeshayahu was repeating himself to try to get more action on his words. Chirdu Sha'ananot. Rigaza botachot, pshota ve'ora v'chagora al chalatzayim. Tremble, you ones at ease. Quake, you confident ones. Strip down, poshta, pshota, become naked, ve'ora, wear sackcloth on your hips, v'chagora al chalatzayim. If we're speaking literally about women, I doubt it really means that they're stripping down naked, but rather it probably means that they're changing their fancy clothes for clothes of mourning. If the women are a metaphor for the as-yet wealthy cities of Eretz Yehuda, who will soon be brought down low, well, you could imagine, you could use your imagination to imagine how the cities will change using these metaphoric descriptions. Al Shadayim Sofadim, Al Stei Chemed, Al Gefen, Poriah, pound on your chests in mourning for the desirable fields, for the fruitful vineyards, that is, for the expected destruction of them. Mourn over them. Again, this can be understood both on the metaphoric level as well as on the literal level. In fact, I think Yeshayahu wants us to understand both levels, because that's why he's using an alliteration between the word Shadayim, breasts, and Sedei, which are fields. And also he uses the word poriah, the fruitfulness of the fields and of the vineyards, where the word poriah as fruitfulness also applies to people as well, especially women. There is another way to understand this verse, which is that every woman should mourn, that is, al shadayim sofadim, the mourner should mourn over the fields as well as the women's breasts. And the idea being that in times of starvation, women dry up completely. They're no longer to give the mass starvation that you have and the pestilence that you have at times of war, that the women really dries, women dry up, and there is no way for them to feed even their infants. So you think at least infants would be able to survive the starvation, but because their mothers are starving, the children starve as well. Now, what very often happens here, actually, in biblical poetry, is that the metaphor fades away, and the meaning behind the metaphor fades in. So up to this verse, we're very much referring to women, who we believe, I believe, is our metaphors for the cities, as well as being literal. But now there's a shift in the middle of this pasuk from Shadayim, where we're talking about women, to Stechemen and Geffen, which are talking about the fields, which are going to be decimated along with the cities. So it's kind of nice. If you picture it in a movie, you have one image fading out and another image fading in behind it. The metaphor disappears, and the literal destruction of the cities starts to fade in. Al Admat Ami, Kotz v'shamir ta'aleh Ki al kol batei masos kirya aliza. On the land of my nation, or perhaps if it's a continuation from the previous verse, in mourning over the land of my nation, will be overgrown, or which will be overgrown with thorns and thistles, kots v'shamir, indeed in every house of joy and every city of happiness. Now, what we have here is a literal image of the destroyed cities combined with the metaphor of the thorns and the thistles, because as I've mentioned before, in chapter 7 and 9, we discovered that the thorns and the thistles are the arrows and the slings of the armies of Ashur. So these cities will be invaded, but not so much by the metaphoric thorns and thistles, although that will happen later after the destruction, but by the armies, the swords and the arrows, the slings of Ashur. Ki Armon Nutash, Hamon Ir Uzav, Ofel Vafachan Haya Be'ad Me'arot Ad Olam, Mesos Piraim Mir'e Adarim. Since the towers will be cast down, the cities of the masses, or the boisterous cities, Hamon Ir, will be abandoned. Citadels, Ofel, and towers, Vachan, those are places where you can see things, Bochein, you can identify things from afar, become like caverns forever. They're a joy for donkeys and pastures for the flocks. That is, they're abandoned lands where only animals graze around. And of course, there's more metaphor here. Notice that the word mesos paraim, a joy for the donkeys, the word pereh, which is a wild donkey, is also a symbol for Yishmael, v'hu yihye pereh adam. So it could be that at that time, the people, the Ishmaelite nation, which was really wasn't a nation, but it were these traders who traded in the Arabian desert called Kedar, and the people called Kedar, they may very well have taken sides with the Assyrians against the nation of Yehuda when the Assyrians came to destroy the city. Everybody wants to get in on the quote-unquote fun. But now, some signs of hope. That is, after the end of this, essentially Yeshaya was warning the cities to start their mourning process and to be aware that, except for Yushalayim, things would be completely stripped bare, a time of war and pestilence so nightmarish that really would be probably unparalleled since Moab's time 100 years later, and probably would not be paralleled again until far into the future, maybe during Roman times. But, of course, there's always the return to hope in Yeshayahu, always the guarantee that Yerushalayim, of all the cities in Yehuda, will be saved. Ad ye'are aleinu ruach mimarom v'haya midbar la'karmel v'ha'karmel la'ya'ar ye'chashev. Until the Spirit from on high flows down on us, and the desert will become farmland, and the farmland will be counted as a forest. Of course, this is a metaphor, and the metaphor really goes back to the beginning of this chapter, which is identified in the next pasuk. V'shachan b'midbar mishpat u'tzdaka b'karmel teshev. That is, what is the forest that will become a farmland of the previous verse, and what is the farmland that will be considered like a great forest? V'shachan b'midbar mishpat. In that desert will dwell justice, that is justice from the king that will do justice, and from the officers that will do justice, just as mentioned at the very beginning of this parak. And note, of course, the word vishachan, which of course references Shekhinah, or God's presence returning to Jerusalem. Continuing on with this pasuk, in the desert, justice will dwell and righteousness will dwell, teshev, or rule, in the farmlands. Perhaps the farlands are a reference to the outlying fields and the communities which will come back to life after the time of restoration of Jerusalem. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, that's how the Ibn Ezra says. The Ibn Ezra says that there really won't need to be walls or a yar. People will be able to live in the field successfully because the fear of Ashur will have gone. V'haya ma'aseh ha-tzedakah shalom. V'avodat ha-tzedakah shkeit v'vetach ad olam. Notice the continuing comparison between tzedakah and mishpat, which shows up everywhere in the Torah. And the product of justice is peace. That is, if you do your justice right, then you'll have shalom. And the result of calm and confidence is being always confident. It's important to be careful about words like ad olam in Tanakh. here ad olam is that there will be peace or confidence ad olam forever. But it's not always as absolute as that. For instance, in a few psukim before, a few verses before, we were promised that the city would be turned into abandoned caves ad olam until the next stage, until the spirit from God came down from on high. So you have to be careful with ad olam. It doesn't necessarily mean forever and ever and ever and ever, like in a messianic way. It can mean until the next stage of life. V'yashav ami b'nevei shalom uv mishkenot mivtachim uvim nuchot shananot. And my nation will dwell in the city of peace, nevei shalom, in confident communities, mishkenot mivtachim, and untroubled resting places, Minuchot Sha'ananot, and that is a healing for the Nashim Sha'ananim. And there the word Sha'anan was not so positive. It was like people that were a little too confident and too untroubled when they needed to wake up and shake out of their reverie. But sometimes when there's real Menucha, and Menucha tends to have a messianic flavor to it, then there will be real Sha'anan, real peace and comfort, ones that's deserved. And now, as we often do, we never forget the comeuppance that the oppressors deserve, their punishment. Because ultimately, you can't have all the peace that's been stated before unless oppression is removed. And sometimes it needs to be removed in very harsh ways. And the representation of the enemy is once again that capital city of the oppressor, whether it was Nineveh or Babel or some future city. It's always that city which represents the might of the oppressors. Uvarad beredet hayar, uva shifla tishbal ha'ir. And with hail, as the forest falls, ya'ar, in the lowest way, the city, ir, will fall. Now, there's a lot of rhymes here, so it works much, much better in Hebrew. Uvayar, uvair, uva shifla tishbal, uvarad beredet. But it could be the barad beredet is that when the forest and the fortifications and the city will fall of the oppressors, it will be like falling hailstones from the stones that fall out of it. But again, it works kind of better in Hebrew than it does in English. And ultimately, in the last pasuk, we go back to the nation of Yehuda, the children of Israel. Ashrechem zorei al kol mayim, mishalchei regel ashor v'hachamor. Wealthy and happy are those who could sow on every waterway and work their donkeys and cattle, or their donkeys and their oxen everywhere.